Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this week's episode, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jane, your host, and this week's episode features guest Professor Jeff Green from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, or better known as UNC. And today we discuss the importance of self-regulated learning, especially as students navigate throughout the online world during their educational career. So I hope you guys enjoy this week's episode, and I'll see you at the end.
My name is Jeff Green. I'm a professor of educational psychology and the learning sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I study the science of learning.
Okay, awesome. So how long have you been in the psychology field, and how do you think it's grown since you entered it?
So I got my PhD in educational psychology in 2007. So that's what, 16 years or so? Doesn't feel like 16 years, but I guess it is. The field's really changed over time in lots of ways. I think some of the ones that pop out immediately, you know, I think psychology for a long time, very understandably, was very focused on how people think and the mind and that kind of thing. And it's not like psychologists didn't care about what was happening outside of the person, but I think their focus on that has increased over time. And in particular, I think psychologists now are much more cognizant of social factors, cultural factors, historical factors. The American Psychological Association recently issued an apology for engaging in racism and, you know, not coming out against racism and white supremacy and other things. And so I think the field is really taking a hard look at itself and trying to better understand how people exist in the world and what psychology can do to help them be more successful and make the world a better place for them. And that kind of focus is an essential part of psychology, but I think it's one that hasn't gotten as much attention as it needs. And hopefully people are beginning to change that.
Yeah, sounds like a danger of events. And kind of like having, it's pretty recent, I'd say, especially like after COVID, because everyone's like shut down and then everyone like turned to online. So all of a sudden it's like, boom, everything's happening at once.
Yeah, people are much more connected now, and it's easier to, you know, talk to each other and hear from each other. And there's a lot of good things that come from that, but there's also a lot of, you know, disturbing things that you come across when you can hear from anyone at any time.
So what motivated you or like pushed you to go into the psychology field?
So, you know, I was kind of a dork. I read psychology books when I was in high school. I always found it really interesting. And no one in my family was involved in psychology prior to me that I'm aware of. I just kind of always was interested in how people think and how to maybe think about the world differently. How can we change the way that we think about the world to kind of help us be more successful? So I think was my initial interest. And then, you know, over time, I really started focusing in on learning because, you know, there's this saying that research is me search. So people study what they struggle with or, you know, what kind of gives them trouble. And I, you know, I was pretty good in school and pretty good in college. But then in college, like I really hit some roadblocks. Like I really started struggling with learning and understanding, and I didn't have different tools. I didn't have, you know, like I had a couple study strategies and those were my go-tos. And when they didn't work, I had nothing left. I didn't know what to do. And I really struggled for a while. And I wanted to study how to help people not end up in the same place I was in.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of students, they just try to cram everything the night before and they're not really taught like specialized, I guess, study strategies that can actually help them. And especially because everyone's learning differently. So if you like to just sit in a lecture, and maybe not everyone absorbs it all. So I think it's really important to learn like what works for you.
Totally, yeah. And, you know, I mean, some students are lucky, right? For whatever reason, they kind of get exposed to ideas from the science of learning, like, you know, cramming, it's not such a great thing, that there's more to studying than just reading and highlighting. Some students kind of learn that stuff and that's awesome, but lots of students don't. And I think for the students that don't, it can be a real challenge, you know? I mean, some students get by on sheer kind of, you know, brain power, through high school sometimes, and maybe even to college. But at some point, everybody kind of hits that wall, and you got to have some backup plans. You got to have some different ways of studying or learning. And it's, you know, like it's not it's not rocket science, but it's not intuitive. It's not easy. Like, it's not obvious. And so helping people kind of learn those study skills and, you know, how to better understand themselves, like you said, like people learn differently. Understanding how you learn best is really important to try to help people to spend some time figuring out.
So you mentioned the term science of learning. Could you go a little further into what that is?
Yeah. So the science of learning is a really broad term, but I like to think about it just as, you know, taking a rigorous approach to understanding how different people learn and how to create environments where people can learn successfully. So, you know, you talked about cramming. So lots of students cram and they feel like they're successful, and we need to take that seriously, right? So the science of learning would say, like, okay, let's really study cramming. Like, let's really try to understand, like, does it work? How does it work? Does it work for some people but not other people? If it doesn't work, what works better? And that's the science of learning. So we did a lot of rigorous research, not me, but other people. And they figured out that cramming actually isn't the best way to study, and that when you space out your learning, you remember more of it more easily in less time. And that took a lot of kind of science, a lot of rigorous investigation to figure out. There's lots of other things in learning, whether it's motivation, the role of emotions in learning, the role of other people, different kinds of study strategies. All those things can be studied. And what we try to do is do the work and then put together some advice for people. You know, here's some things to try. Here's some things that maybe don't work so well, like learning styles don't work so well. And helping people understand that hopefully will help them be more successful.
How do you, this is a pretty broad question, so you can take it how you want, but how do you think education and psychology are correlated or associated with each other?
So I think there's a real strong correlation, and I'm glad you kind of framed it that way. Like, they relate to one another. It's not, psychology is not the only thing that matters in education, right? Like, there's education's, it involves, you know, school policies and teachers and psychology and sociology and anthropology. You know, in a school of education like mine here at the University of North Carolina, we have professors that study the sociology of education, the history of education, et cetera. And all that matters, right? And good education isn't just about psychology, but psychology is a piece of it. It plays a role in it. And one of the things I like to talk about is how I can't tell teachers this is exactly how you should teach, right? People are different, teachers are different, students are different. But there's psychological research that suggests that there are certain ways of teaching that might be more likely to be successful than others. And there are some things that once teachers and students understand regarding how people think and how people learn, it'll help them kind of eliminate some unlikely to be useful strategies and focus on ones that are more likely to be successful. So I think the more teachers and students know about psychology and learning, the more likely it is that they'll be successful.
So you're mentioning, like, there's a few strategies. Another one of your research topics in your biography besides science of learning was self-regulated learning. Is that something under it, or is that, like, a completely different sector?
It's a piece of the science of learning for sure. Yeah. So self-regulated learning, like, the idea is that we want students to be kind of active, thoughtful, purposeful learners, right? So many students have kind of a default set of strategies, right? So when it's time to learn something, maybe they read the book, maybe they do some highlighting, maybe they take some notes, and that's it. And, you know, if that works, awesome, right? Cool, keep doing it. But, you know, for certain topics and certain points of students' career, maybe those things don't work so well. And self-regulated learning is about developing the skills to recognize when those strategies aren't working so well. And then, like, problem solve, like, figure out, like, okay, why isn't this working? Like, you know, do I have the wrong goal, or am I just using the wrong strategies, or do I need to change the way I'm thinking about myself? And all of that involves self-regulation, which is like thinking about yourself and making changes based upon your goals and what you think is best to help you learn. And so, you know, when people are doing the things that have always worked for them, they don't need to self-regulate much, and it's, you know, pretty natural. When things aren't going well, they really need to be thoughtful and intentional about their learning. And those skills are a little harder. And so we focus on teaching students how to develop those skills to really problem solve and figure out, you know, when things aren't going right, how can I get back on track?
Biggest thing that's pretty easy for, like, high schoolers and, like, undergrad students is repeat the same cycle. So being able to determine, like, wait, this isn't working, and actively trying to change it rather than just going through it again and again makes a huge difference.
Totally. I mean, you know, listen, it's a bummer when you got to like change things up, right? Like everyone's busy. High school students today are busier than ever. And like, you know, you probably have a ton of things to do and you don't want to take time to be like, I got to stop what I normally do and think differently and try different things. But, you know, the reality is that all of us at some point encounter something where our tried and true strategies don't work so well. And that's when self-regulation kicks in and you got to put in the time and effort to figure out how to switch things up.
So do you have like a specific course on this, or is it just like under your classes?
So I teach a bunch of different kinds of courses, and it's a piece of most courses that I teach. I can usually figure out a way to get it in there no matter what I'm teaching. But I have taught in the past courses solely devoted to that topic, both at the undergraduate level. So I taught a science of learning course at the undergraduate level, and we talked a lot about self-regulation. This past semester, I taught a course called The Art and Science of Expertise with two other professors, and self-regulation is a big piece of developing expertise. So I talked about it there. And then I teach graduate level courses for people who want to become researchers. And I teach about self-regulated learning there, but more about kind of like, how do we study this and how can we learn more about it?
So did you have like a specific research study on this, or how did you discover this, I guess?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I went to into my doctoral program to study the science of learning and educational psychology, and I kind of had a totally different focus, a totally different interest. And then I took a course with Dr. Roger Azevedo, who taught about cognition and self-regulated learning. And in his class, I was like, oh, that's the thing I want to study. Like, that's it. Like, that's what I want to do. And I kind of followed him around like a puppy dog for a while until he agreed to take me on as a student. And then he taught me about self-regulated learning and then kind of went from there. But I mean, I think that happens a lot, right? Like it's tough to be interested in something you don't know anything about, right? So it's not like, for most people, it's not like you have this moment of inspiration where you're like, all of a sudden you're like, you know what I love? Whales. I want to study whales. Like that doesn't happen, yeah. Right? What happens is you kind of like, you bump into someone, someone tells you something, you're like, that's really interesting. I want to know more about it. And that's what happened to me. I was on one track, took a great course from a great person and realized, oh, that's the thing I want
to do. One of your big studies is like using internet and being able to use it into studying. Like one of your studies was talking about like using videos and like asking questions along the way. Could you explain more about that and like how that's changed, especially as COVID, when we've like been stuck online this whole time?
Totally. Yeah. So a lot of my research has involved learning online because like it's really like it requires a lot of self-regulation, right? Like when you're online, it's really tempting to like, you know, you're trying to study, you're trying to, you know, search the internet for an answer to a question. It's really tempting to like check your email or jump on YouTube or TikTok or whatever and kind of get distracted. So part of my research is about like how do people kind of inhibit those distractions and kind of say, no, I got to stay on track. But another part is there's just so much information online. Like it's impossible to read it all. You've got to make decisions about, well, I'm going to focus on this piece of information or that website or this website. And so part of self-regulation is making good choices about what you focus on. And one way to do that is by kind of asking yourself questions, right? So as you're reading something, you know, you Google something, you go to the first link, maybe you don't totally recognize the web address, but you check it out. And as you read, you should really be kind of asking yourself questions like, is this making sense? And does it seem to match up with other things I've read about this topic in the past or not? And do I know anything about the author? And, you know, if the answer to a lot of those questions are no, then you got to start thinking about like, maybe I'm not in the best place. You know, maybe what I'm reading isn't reliable or is sadly on the internet, there's stuff out there to try to trick you or to try to, you know, kind of get you to believe some things that are really dangerous. And so I think when people go online to learn, they've got to really be self-regulating to be asking themselves questions about like, should I really be using this website? And, you know, if not, what should I do to get out of it? Where should I go next?
Yeah. So I know it's like one of the biggest things for like students is like staying on task. So when they're learning this self-regulated learning, do you like find a certain way for them to like be like, oh, I have to do this? Because like a lot of times, like you said, they'll easily get distracted and like they'll go on like social media or whatever it is that's not like their research topic or their how to discover the best way for them to stay on task, especially as they start, because it's hard to start a habit when they've been doing it for so long.
Totally. Yeah. So there's two really great things that you asked about there. And the second one I'll take first, which is if you've gotten into the habit of kind of like always being distracted by social media or whatever, I mean, that is hard to break, no doubt, right? And it's going to take effort. Like, it's not going to feel good. Like, and you got to kind of force yourself to do it, but also be kind of kind to yourself. Like, it's not going to go away right away, right? So, you know, if you're checking social media every 2 minutes while studying, it's not like you're just going to, most people can't just stop that right away. You're going to have to set some goals for yourself, right? Like, I'm going to try to go 5 minutes. Okay, now I'm going to try to go 10 minutes, right? Tomorrow I'm going to try to go for 15 minutes, right? You got to kind of build up and practice, you know, build up that tolerance and practice. But for people who haven't yet kind of gotten into the habit of always checking social media or the habit of being distracted online, it's a lot easier to set up an environment where you won't be distracted than it is to try to resist distractions, right? So I tell students, and the research backs this up, like if you can find a space like in your house or a coffee shop or a library, wherever, where like it's just the study space, you don't do anything else there, right? Like that's great, because as you do nothing but study in that space, your brain will begin to associate that space with just studying, and you're less likely to be tempted and thinking about like social media and that kind of thing. Another thing that's really good is to try to just shut those things off before you get started, right? So I know students, they'll like take their phone and they'll stick it like in another room, you know, or like they'll tell someone to take it so it can't distract them. You know, a lot of software nowadays on your computer can set up, like you can say, like, just shut everything off for an hour. Don't let me access it. You know, I think doing that, making a good plan to not be distracted, you're much more likely to be successful in resisting temptations when they're just not there, as opposed to like trying to resist them when they happen. So, you know, it's like, you know, when I'm trying to lose weight, I don't go to my favorite donut shop because it's just impossible to resist, right? Same thing with distractions online. Like the more you can do to make it sure that you don't even encounter them, the more successful you'll be.
And also it's really important, like you said, like having a designated area. That's why it's not good to like do everything. Like I know a lot of people, like students will just do everything in their bedroom. Like they'll eat, sleep, and study on their bed. And it's like, that's not healthy. And then like it merges everything and you're just not productive at all.
I mean, and I get it, right? Like your bedroom's comfortable and it's where all your stuff is. Like, I totally get it. But like, even when it comes to like sleep's super important for learning. And if you do homework or studying on your bed, it's harder to go to sleep. It's harder to shut off your brain and like not think about the homework because you're in the same space. And so, you know, trying as much as possible to make the bedroom a place where, you know, no studying, no deep thinking, I just sleep here. And then having somewhere else where you do all that work, it'll probably help you do that work better and probably help you sleep better too.
With these studies that you found, do you try to implement it in your children's lives or do you like just back off?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, like we talk about it, I think, you know, my kids don't see me as like anything but dad, right? And, you know, kids sometimes really want to talk to dad and sometimes they want dad to stop talking. So it's kind of, I try to do it more like when they come to me, like, you know, I try not to push it on them, cause that never works, but like, you know, if they're having trouble or they have a question or I see them struggling, I might be like, you know, have you thought about this or do you want to talk about it? So I think they do some of the stuff that I recommend, but I don't think they do all of it, which is fine. You know, everybody's different.
So another thing in your background, you were talking about how students, for kindergarten through graduate school and their capability to achieve goals. So how does it differ between the different age groups? Because I know most of your studies are talking about like undergrad. So have you gone into other age groups?
I've done some work with high school and a little bit with middle school. And, you know, I think often the differences are more about what they've already learned and what they're comfortable with. So younger kids have had less practice usually studying and less practice self-regulating, and they also tend to know a little less than older kids, right? That makes sense. Just we learn more as we grow. So often it's not that they can't self-regulate, but it's harder for them. And so maybe we need to come up with some different strategies or some different ways to kind of organize things so it's in more manageable chunks for them. So I like to say that the vast majority of people have all the brain stuff they need to be successful, right, at what they want to do. It's about learning how to work with what you have and trying to kind of maximize your capacity. But most people can get to where they want to go. Sometimes they just need some help figuring out some different strategies to get there.
Yeah, of course. For one of your studies on the how do students' achievement goals relate to learning from well-designed instructional videos and subsequent exam performance, could you talk a little bit more about that and the conclusion that you found with the other researchers?
Yeah, so that study was led by Dr. Shelby Kuhlman, who's great. She's going to be a professor at the University of Memphis this fall. And, you know, what she was interested in looking at was how students' motivation relates to how they engage in videos and then how that engagement then predicts learning. So, yeah, like you said, a lot of education has moved online. During COVID, obviously, almost everyone was online for some part of the time. But even post or whatever we call this next phase of COVID, you know, a lot of instructors are posting videos, they're recording lectures and putting them online. So students need to, you know, kind of from home or from wherever, watch these videos. And it's real easy to be kind of passive when you watch the video, right? Like it's real easy to kind of treat it like TV and just kind of stare at it and, you know, just kind of let it wash over you. But as Shelby talks about in the paper, it's important to be engaged. It's important to be active. And the more active and engaged you are while you watch videos, whether it's taking notes or asking yourself questions or pausing and kind of rewinding when you don't understand something, whatever it may be, that kind of activity really helps people learn. So her next question was, well, you know, how do students become motivated to engage actively? And what she found was there are certain kinds of motivational orientations that made it more likely for students to be engaged. And the big one was, were they learning because they really wanted to understand the material, or were they learning because they were really worried about their grade? Students that are really worried about the grade, you know, beyond anything else, tend to take a more passive approach. They tend to just kind of want to get through it and kind of move on. Whereas students that are really focused on trying to learn tend to be more active and tend to do better. So students have lots of different motivations. There's not just one kind of motivation, but certainly this orientation towards learning versus just kind of getting the grade is one kind of motivation. And it does seem like being oriented towards understanding and learning is better than just trying to get that A or get that B, or like some students, like just barely, I just want to pass, you know, like that. Understandable, but it's better to try to focus on learning.
Yeah, of course. After that study, how have you guys learned from it and like branched off from it or gone into different questions after the study?
Yeah. So there's a lot of cool questions that can follow that study. It's a pretty recent one. So we're still doing, you know, we haven't gone super far past that, but some of the things that we're doing, so, and Shelby's really leading this work, you know, there's a lot to be learned by the ways in which students engage with videos, right? So she's done some super cool work to analyze like how people are or are not being active with the video. Are they fast forwarding? Are they rewinding? Are they rewatching things? And she's found that that can predict learning. She's really good at designing videos. And so she's looking at kind of like, how do you design and record and structure the video so that students can be successful? You know, like, what are the multimedia learning principles? What are the multimedia learning principles that help people learn? Like, for example, it's usually not great to have like a ton of text in a video, nor is it great to have only talking, right? You want to kind of mix it up. And, you know, if you have pictures, you want the pictures to match what you're talking about. They shouldn't just be kind of distracting or just there to kind of, you know, make people laugh. Although that's not a bad thing. You want the pictures to be relevant to what the video is about. And so there are all these principles about how to design a good video to really help people learn that she's studying, that she's implementing, and then looking at how students use those videos to learn successfully.
So like we said before, because internet's like become a big part of everyone's lives, especially after COVID now, how, I guess, do like students continue to like, especially like a lot of like lecture videos sometimes are like an hour long and students will just play in the background or like I guess, like, have it as a background noise audio. So how do students, like, navigate it when they're, I guess, not motivated at all?
Yeah, that's really hard. And, you know, I have a ton of respect for teachers and educators, and I'm one of them, right? So I know it's hard. But, you know, honestly, sometimes they don't get a lot of training in how to design a good video. And so sometimes they do post like an hour and a half video of them just talking. And I mean, that's tough to get through, right? I mean, it's tough to be motivated to watch that. And so when students are faced with that, I think there's a couple things they can do. I mean, one thing is to think about the relevance of what they're learning. So, you know, can a student kind of go, listen, this is my favorite thing to do, but if I do well understanding the material in this video, it's going to help me, you know, pass this course, which helps me get one step closer to my career that I want to do, that kind of thing. That can help them find the motivation. I do think getting engaged with the video can help too. So, I mean, the reality is that we learn what we think about and we remember things that we find meaning in, right? So just playing a video in the background, if you're not really paying attention to it, you're not going to learn or remember it. So, you know, can you find a hook, right? Like, can you figure out like, okay, this relates to something I really care about? Or, you know, can you force yourself to start taking notes in your own words? And sometimes just the process of getting that started can get you more engaged and then make it easier to get through. You can certainly break it up. A lot of those videos, you can do like the Pomodoro technique, right? Where the Pomodoro technique is where you learn for like 25 minutes and then you give yourself a 5 minute break and then another 25 and then five. So, you know, breaking it up sometimes works too and can kind of help you refresh, but there aren't a lot of shortcuts when it comes to learning, and you really gotta be present and you gotta be thinking about what you're trying to learn. And so just playing it in the background, tempting. I know it's tempting, but it's you're not gonna get there doing that.
So you mentioned before how education is education is compromised of a ton of different sectors, and one of them is psychology. So how do you think it could benefit teachers if they took a course on like how to, it's like make their teaching and interactions with children more efficient so that it will also improve their learning? And I know like there's a lot of like, you can take like general psychology, like a ton of people do, and that's probably one of like a required course, but it's not specified towards, I guess, like geared towards teaching children.
Yeah, I mean, it really varies. So this is a really complex topic, but I'm glad you asked about it. So preparing teachers, I think, takes a lot of time, right? I mean, we want to do it as efficiently as possible. I don't want to waste any teacher or, you know, pre-service or expecting teachers' time. But there's a lot to learn, right? You got to learn content. You got to learn pedagogy. And I think psychology does help. The reality is that nowadays, there's more and more pressure to get people through teacher training programs as quickly as possible. And so they're cutting back. And I understand that pressure, right? Students don't want to be in school forever. They want to get out and start making money. School districts need teachers desperately. And so they're like, can you please get these people done as soon as you can, as quickly as you can? But I do think, like you said, many, but not all teacher preparation programs have a course on the science of learning or the psychological aspects of learning and teaching. I think they're really valuable. I think they're helpful because they help teachers do what they do better, right? So like I mentioned learning styles earlier, like learning styles is this really popular myth, right? So many people think that they have a learning style, like you're either a visual learner or an auditory learner or a kinesthetic learner. And like, it's really well-intentioned and, you know, people absolutely are trying to like differentiate their instruction to be support students. But we've done a ton of research on learning styles and they don't exist. Like people don't have a learning style. I always say the good news is you have all the learning styles, right? The more ways you encounter information, whether it's visually or auditorily, or you do something with it, the better you learn it. Teachers that don't get that message, right, in their coursework, a lot of them spend a lot of time like developing different lesson plans and different teaching strategies for like visual learners and auditory learners, et cetera. And you know, that's admirable, but that's not the best use of their time. And so if they had a course on psychology of learning, I could say to them, okay, It's great that you want to differentiate your instruction to students' needs. That's awesome. Let's just not do it by learning styles. There's a ton of other ways we can do it where there is evidence that it is effective. Let's spend your time wisely. Let's talk about that. And so I do think those kind of courses can really be helpful. I get why they aren't as common as they might be, because there is so much pressure to, you know, make teacher training programs as efficient as possible. But I do think it's something that really helps people learn and help people teach. So I hope more programs continue to keep those classes in their curricula. We'll see.
So you said that there's other ways or like other learning styles that help teachers. Could you talk about that?
Totally, yeah. So one way to differentiate instruction is based upon what students know, right? So we learn new things by connecting it to things that we already know. And each of us know different things, right? I mean, there's some common knowledge maybe in certain areas or certain cultures or among certain people, but each of us brings like our own unique background and culture and history. And so sometimes it can really help for a teacher to really try to learn about their students, what they already know, what their background is, what their culture and their history is, and then find ways to connect the material they're trying to teach to that culture and history. So you can differentiate based upon prior knowledge. You can also differentiate based upon interest, right? So different people have different kinds of interests. And so maybe you can find a way to figure out what students are interested in and then tailor the assignments so that they can learn and display their knowledge based upon something that they're interested in. So a lot of times, like for self-regulation and self-regulated learning, I have students talk about how they self-regulate in their hobby. Like, what do you do to really get good at the thing that you love doing for fun? And then they can apply the ideas of self-regulated learning to something they really are interested in. And that can kind of help them make that connection and see it more clearly. So prior knowledge, interest, you know, there's some other ones, but those are two big ones.
Yeah. I think like biggest, I guess, like counter argument teachers make is that like, especially in like public school and like education, like sometimes if there's students that come from different counties or like even like states or a different country, their prior knowledge is completely different and it's really hard to base it off of one big group when it's like maybe five different groups.
Totally. Yeah, that's real. That's real. And that is really tough. And, you know, teachers have a really challenging job and I don't want to at all suggest otherwise. And so sometimes differentiation is really hard to do and there's not enough hours in the day to do it the way teachers would want. But usually you can find a couple things. You know, maybe there's three topics that, you know, kind of capture the imagination of most students in the class and you can kind of switch it up like that. The other thing is, I mean, I do think there's a need for more teachers, right? Like I really wish in the U.S., like when they do surveys of like parents and people in the community, usually you get two answers. I love my kids' teachers, but I'm skeptical of teachers overall. And that like doesn't make any sense, right? Like if you love your teachers and so the person, like teachers do a really good job for the most part. And so if we could get society to kind of recognize that and value teachers more, you know, pay them more, help them, you know, do their job better, I think we'd have more teachers, and then with more teachers, it would be easier to differentiate because, you know, there wouldn't be as many students per teacher.
Yeah, I'm so, like, I know because my parents are from China, but, like, in China, like, teachers and elders are respected very greatly, and, like, school is obviously a big prioritization, and it's completely different compared to the United States.
Yeah, that's a bummer. I mean, and, you know, I really do think it's kind of like it's this social kind of myth, I don't know, like whenever I talk to people, I'm like, you know, what do you think of the teachers that are working with your kids? Oh, my teachers are great. You know, I'm like, what do you think of teaching? I don't know. You know, and I'm like, put it together. No, teachers are doing a great job. Let's help them do better. So, yeah, I like what you said about China. There's other places around the world that, you know, similarly respect teachers. And I think we can do it here in the United States. We just got to kind of put our minds to it.
It's also hard because like, well, yeah, we'll have like a small group of people, but over the whole population, it's hard for everyone to get to that same thinking when they've been ingrained in the same way for such a long time.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, that's where it gets back to like, you know, when you're on the internet, right? Like when you're reading something or hearing something, you have to ask like, okay, where did they get this information? And, you know, is it accurate? And, you know, gosh, if you really like all the teachers that you know, then why don't you like teachers? You know, like ask yourself.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking your time out of your day to do this.
Sure, it was really fun. It was nice talking to you.
Hi, guys, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode as much as I did, and even took away some information that you can apply to your own life. Thank you so much to Professor Green once again for providing insight on this topic, and have a wonderful rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and I'll see y'all next time.